And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We have two interviews for you today, one newly recorded with the author of a brand new book about raising kids to thrive in a diverse and complicated world. Part two, something much more lighthearted, comes from the Morning Show archives. Here's part one. We'll spend the next few minutes of WGTD's Morning Show talking about an interesting facet of parenting, particularly for parenting as it plays out in the 21st century. It is the idea that we need to raise our young people to be culturally competent. This is a term that has actually been around for a while, but initially termed not at all with children in mind. And indeed, sometimes the assumption is made that when it comes to thinking about things like appreciating other cultures and having a proper appreciation of our own culture and those of others, that this is a matter more for adults. But in fact, there are all kinds of reasons to think about cultural competence, even with young children. And that is the point of this new book called Culturally Competent Kids, Raising Children to Thrive in a Diverse World. It is the contention of my morning show guest, Dr. Samantha C. Sweeney, a psychologist, that these matters need to be thoughtfully and creatively explored by parents, and that even at a young age, it is important that we are guiding our children in a way towards a fuller and deeper appreciation for people who are different from themselves. And this is a book that is laid out with a framework designed to help parents do exactly this. And I'm glad we can talk with Dr. Sweeney about her book, which is published by Bull Publishing, again, titled Culturally Competent Kids, Raising Children to Thrive in a Diverse World. Dr. Samantha C. Sweeney, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm glad we can have this conversation. I think we are venturing into waters that can be a little bit turbulent in the current day. That is, there is, of course, a fairly substantial swath of the American electorate that voices certain concerns about diversity and equity and inclusion and so on. And so you are bravely moving into this. And I think one of the ways in which you indicate that this can be a tricky landscape to navigate is a portion of the book early on in which you take considerable length to talk about various terms like bias and prejudice and diversity and culture and privilege. And that really underscores the fact that not only can people sometimes have differences of opinion about this, but often we are talking about these matters in ways that are careless, in which you use one term in a way and someone else uses that term in a completely different way, and we have people sort of talking past one another. Explain the importance of being clear on our terminology before we venture into talking about something like this.
Sure. I just think it's important when we have conversations that, like you said, that we know what we're each referring to so that we're not talking past each other. And, you know, terms like, you know, diversity, the word diversity especially, that's a special word for me, because I think diversity and culture are often used as euphemisms for like Black or poor or urban. I mentioned this in the book. And, you know, diversity actually means difference. That's the only thing that it means. It just means difference, right? And so, you know, when people are talking about the idea of diversity and, you know, we shouldn't be talking about diversity, what you're actually saying is we shouldn't be talking about difference. I don't think anyone actually feels that way, that we shouldn't be talking about difference. I think people are scared of certain topics that they associate with diversity. And this book is designed to help raise kids who are not afraid of those topics, who can have conversations around these important topics. And then that translates to treating other people who are different from you with respect. And we mean all children. So I know people are going to hear the topic of this book and they're going to think, oh, this is just about race. And it certainly is, and that's certainly important, but it's also about gender. It's also about age. It's also about disability. It's about language. It's about all of these different things that encapsulate culture.
Mm. At one point you say, how can we create a world where differences are respected and celebrated rather than simply tolerated? One of the things that you say as you explain a little further about this notion of cultural competence is that you say it is a skill, not some innate trait that you either have or don't have. It is not a skill that you develop on your own. And I think it's really important for us to acknowledge this, because I think sometimes we like to think that young children have this, in a sense, beautiful color blindness. I mean, where they are not yet encumbered by all of the categorization that most of us have, and us and them, and they have this sort of sweet natured openness. And what you really tell us in the book is that actually from a remarkably early age, young children are already going about the business of categorization and of noticing differences and so on. And if we're not careful, a child can develop very regrettable ideas about I'm better than you, or other sorts of prejudices that we might not want them to embrace. Talk for a moment about this notion that we have that children have this kind of natural state of openness to difference that I think you believe is actually not the case.
Sure. So I think in some ways that is true, that children, not that they're colorblind, but they have not yet assigned value at, you know, from very, very young ages. They haven't assigned value to what these different, you know, different areas of diversity are. I have an anecdotal story. When I was younger, just out of my undergraduate degree, I taught at a preschool, and I taught three-year-olds. And I remember a young little white three-year-old boy coming up to me and saying that I had darker skin because I spent more time out in the sun. And I said, well, not quite. But I think that it just showed curiosity, right? But he absolutely noticed that I looked different from him. And that's true for all kids. They notice, you know, we teach our kids color. They notice when someone is a different color than somebody else. And so kids at a very young age understand this idea that people look different. It's as they get older and older that they start to assign value to it. And it really happens at such a young age. It can start as early as four. The kids are starting to assign value to groups based on the behavior of just a few individuals within that group. And by age six, they can actually start to develop a strong dislike for somebody who is not a part of their group or a part of their out-group, whatever that means to them, right? That could be based on gender. That could be based on race. It could just be based on interest, but it could be based on a number of things. And by age eight, so like second, third grade for kids in this country, in the U.S., kids are actually willing to discriminate against other kids in other groups if it means keeping the social status of their group and the people that they're associated with. And what we want to try to do is help break that down for kids and have them not assign value based on, you know, what they see, you know, what they hear about their parents talking about, or what they see, you know, on the TV in the background, or what they hear on the street, or a book that they read that maybe was, showed things that are a little bit more discriminatory. So we just have to be careful about the way in which we talk to kids about this type of thing, so that they are learning the things that we actually want them to learn.
Hmm. We're speaking with Dr. Samantha C. Sweeney about her book, Culturally Competent Kids, Raising Children to Thrive in a Diverse World. One point that you make early in the book that I really appreciated is when you talked about this practice of what's sometimes called categorization. And again, when we sort of think about this, I think on at least a subliminal level, probably a lot of us wish that that just didn't happen at all. That when we looked at each other, all that we saw was a human being, and that we weren't paying attention to, you know, they're tall and I'm short, or they're black and I'm white, or they're muscular and I'm out of shape, or whatever. I mean, you know, why do we have to put people into categories? But you tell us in the book, as human beings, this is something that we naturally do. It is a way that we kind of make sense of the world, and that not all categorization is necessarily bad. It's just we have to be careful about how we do that. And I suppose for young children, it's maybe especially important that they are not carelessly categorizing or doing it in a very cavalier, dismissive sort of way.
Absolutely. I mean, yes, we naturally do this. It's actually a safety mechanism, right? We categorize as humans at a very young age, so we understand who we're safe with. So we want to recognize the faces of people around us, because those are the people that we know have kept us safe and will continue to keep us safe. So categorization on its own is not necessarily a bad thing. It's the value that we assign to that categorization that is that can be potentially harmful. I think one of the most obvious things that we see of this on the playground is boys versus girls, right? We see an awful lot of that especially at young ages, that, you know, boys have cooties, girls have cooties. I know that was very common when I was little. Or all the boys in the class are whatever. All the girls in the class are, you know, not as smart, or you know, not as athletic, or, you know, whatever it is that kids are saying, or not as kind, or what have you. And so we just want to make sure that when we're doing this kind of natural categorization, that it's not something that endures, right? It's not something where we always have this idea that girls are more inferior to boys, right? That they're not as smart, that they're not as capable, because we know that that's not true. And if we kind of allow this categorization to kind of continue without challenging it, then it can endure into adulthood.
Before we dig into some of the specifics in the heart and soul of the book, I want you to explain something that you say in the book's preface. You say, this book has been years, even decades, in the making. Explain what you mean by that. In what way does this book spring from decades of life experience for you?
Sure. Well, I talk a little bit about this in the book as well, but I understood the importance of culture and cultural difference at a very young age. When I was 2 years old, my biological father passed away. I am African American or black. My biological family is black. And when I was a little bit older, my mother remarried a white man with two white sons. And so I got to have a front row seat at a very young age to the different ways in which people are treated based on, you know, their race. And so, for example, I have an older sister, and sometimes my white father would, you know, we would go into stores with my father and my sister and I, and salespeople would sometimes only talk to my sister and I as if we weren't with my father. Like that he couldn't possibly be responsible for these two little black girls. And so when I was little, we thought it was funny. We kind of laughed it off. But it was something that I noticed from a very young age. And you know, as I grew up and experienced these different things, as a teenager and then as an adult, in my own family, we are a culturally diverse family. My husband is white. My two kids are biracial. And so, you know, this is something that comes up continually for me in my own personal life. And so it was something that I've always kind of wanted to explore more deeply. And so, yeah, I think because of that, this book was born at kind of just the right time.
Explain what you see as the connection between the tragic murder of George Floyd and the topic that we are talking about today.
Oh, absolutely. So George Floyd is really what spurned me to you know, the direct thing that spurred me to write this book. When he was murdered, I think we were kind of, you know, this was at the height of COVID, and we recognized that, you know, everybody was home, everybody was kind of paying more attention to the news, and realizing what was going on. And so all of the protests that were happening and people recognizing the injustice of what happened to this man helped me to have conversations with other people who were saying to me, oh, I really want to talk to my kids about this. You know, how do I have these kinds of conversations? Or what do I say in an age-appropriate way? You know, they didn't want to scare their kids, right? But at the same time, they felt that it was important to talk about it, and they didn't know how to do that. And so I had lots of conversations and lots of people coming to talk to me and saying, this is something that I want to really talk about. And so that really made me realize that I really needed to put pen to paper and create a framework or a guide so that people who did want to have these conversations had a way to do it, and lots of different entry points, lots of different ways in which they can approach it in a way that makes them comfortable, in a way that makes them able to have these conversations with their own kids.
At one point you say, parenting is an art form that benefits from flexibility, but it's also helpful when it's based on science and features some structure and guidance. And so that is what you have sought to create in your book, Culturally Competent Kids. At one point you say, it is a framework that is simple but not simplistic. Explain what you see as the importance between providing some kind of fairly sturdy framework and yet one that allows for quite a great deal of flexibility. And how challenging was it to try to create something that is all of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's just such an important piece of this process. I'm a parent myself, and I know how important it is to have flexibility in pretty much anything that you do with parenting, right? If there is only one way to do anything, that's going to tend to be a failure for most parents. And so I just think it's so important. And every parent, too, is coming at this from a different place in their own journey, right? You know, their relationship with culture, their relationship with diversity, how comfortable are they talking about these different topics? And so, you know, if we act as if everyone's coming from the ground up, like they don't know anything, that's not going to be helpful to people who are talking about these topics. But if we're coming at it from a place where everybody already knows all of these concepts and ideas, then that's going to leave a lot of people behind. And so I really wanted to give parents a guide that would make it easy for them to infuse into their life. That's one of the chapters called Infusion. And I really wanted to make this accessible for all parents so that they didn't feel overwhelmed. Because I think that's really common for this topic in particular, that it's very easy for parents to feel completely overwhelmed and to feel like they're not equipped to have these conversations. When in fact, I think that all parents are, they just have to come to the conversation with some humility. And with the desire to learn alongside their kids, right? It's not a lecture. So you don't need to know more than your child. You just have to be willing to talk and to kind of be able to learn along with them.
Right. So in your mind, this begins for a given parent with the part of this that you call preparation, doing your own work, in which you call for a given parent to examine themselves and their own biases, their own prejudices, because nothing that follows is going to work if one doesn't begin by being really honest and in assessing your own self and where you're at. And I'm sure for a lot of parents that might be a really difficult thing to do. I have a feeling that's why you call at one point in the book for the reader to be willing to be vulnerable, both as a parent and as a human.
Absolutely. This part is actually, in my view, the most important part of the book, because you as a parent are constantly teaching your child, but we're constantly teaching our children through our actions, through our words, but also through our inactions. We're also teaching them when we are, by our tone of voice, by the different things in which we're doing and what we're willing to talk about, what we're not. Kids are learning from all of that. So if you are able to sit down with your kids and talk about the injustices of gender, but when it comes to race, you know, you're pretty mum on the subject, or you're quiet about it, or you don't want to talk about it, that sends a message, right? Or if you are able to talk about the inequities in, class and socioeconomics, but then when your kid comes home and says, like, I have a trans friend, or there's a new kid in my class who's trans, and you're just like, I don't want to talk, you kind of push the subject away, your kids understand what that means. So you're teaching them things that maybe you don't want to. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you're a terrible person, or that you've done something horribly wrong, or anything like that. It just means that maybe this is something you didn't grow up talking about. Maybe this is not something that was considered to be, acceptable in polite company, when you were younger. And now it is, right? And so you want to send a different message to your children. You want to come kind of evolve and grow with them. And it's much harder to do that if you're not aware of your own stuff.
The second portion of this process, if you will, you call modeling. And that is about, and again, this probably calls for some vulnerability in terms of a given parent being really honest and aware of what kind of example they are setting for their children. And this is also something where it's probably tempting to make very blithe assumptions about that. And you're calling for parents to really look at themselves honestly.
Absolutely. And again, this comes to the nonverbal things that you're saying to your kids. Do you speak in a hushed voice when you talk about certain topics? Are certain topics off limits? All of those things are just so important to be upfront with your kids about. And you're really going to learn something about yourself too. I certainly learned a lot about myself writing this book and thinking about all of these different activities. So if you really are being honest with yourself, you really are being vulnerable, and you go through these different activities and kind of think critically about who you are as a cultural being and what you are showing to your children in terms of the relationship with culture, that is also great modeling for your kids, that it's okay that as a grown adult that you can still be vulnerable and you still have things to learn. And so I think that's a really also important thing to teach your kids.
I appreciated the portion of the book where you talk about this notion of infusion, in integrating cultural competence into your family's life. And what really leapt out at me, and this is because my full-time job, I teach at a college, is a student can always tell when something is being sort of tacked on to a course to sort of maybe pay lip service to a given concept, or sort of a token gesture, versus when something like openness, diversity, and so on is really woven into the fabric of the whole course. And likewise with parenting, if a parent is just going to try to tack on to their parenting this other little piece about being culturally competent, that is not going to have the same staying power as opposed to if such efforts are a part of the day-to-day life of that family. You actually say this is your favorite part of the framework. How does a parent go about doing this?
I love this part of the framework. You know, in my conceptualization of this, it was the first thing that I thought of. And I really think that the best part about this is that you don't really have to do a whole lot of extra stuff. You just have to think as a parent about what you guys already do together as a family and how you can infuse culture into that. So are you big foodies, right? So you already are really into food. You like to try new restaurants, you like to try new recipes, you know, looking up different ways in which you can incorporate different, you know, ingredients or different recipes, or learning little stories about, you know, how cooks really talk about, like, the stories behind their food now. It's not just the recipe itself often. So learning about those different things can be really powerful. Or just going to a different restaurant, maybe on another side of town that you usually don't go to. Is your family really into sports? Pretty much every sport has a relationship with different areas of culture. My family, personally, we're a big tennis family, and so we talk a lot about the Williams sisters and their impact, right? Because the Williams sisters were coming up when I was young. But we also talk a lot about my kids go to a tennis center that really caters to people with disabilities, and so they get to both play with and see people playing who are in wheelchairs, who are veterans, and what that means in terms of the game, and you know what that looks like. And it's really special to be able to recognize that, you know, wheelchair tennis is just as exciting as like able-bodied tennis, and it doesn't take away from the game at all. And so I think just talking about these different things with things that you are already into, things that you are already doing as a family, is really what infusion is all about.
Love that. As the framework progresses through infusion and discussion and so on, you have interesting suggestions about going deeper, about, in a sense, taking this to the next level. In a nutshell, what is important for a parent to remember in terms of going deeper?
Mm-hmm. I think for a lot of people who, you know, are doing different things that maybe is a little bit out of their comfort zone or not something they're not completely used to, it's easier to do that one thing maybe a handful of times and say, okay, I'm good. You know, I'm done with that. But I think the whole point of going deeper is to really make sure that you are, you know, you're not just scratching the surface of whatever it is that you're talking about. All of the different topics that relate to culture have wild amounts of depth, right? And, you know, I say this, I think, in the book as well, that you can't ever be 100% culturally competent, because that would indicate that you know everything there is to know about every culture and you're up to date on everything that's ever changed about any culture. That's just not feasible. And so, but what it does mean, and the exciting part about this, is that there's always more to learn, right? And so by going deeper, you're teaching your child that this is not just something that we talked about once and now we're done. This is an ongoing thing. This is a lifelong, this is something that you want to be learning your whole life. And so how do you help your kid become a lifelong learner of culture, of diversity, of other people, to be curious about people, to be comfortable with talking to other people, asking them questions, learning more about them? That's lifelong. And so going deeper is really about cementing it into your family's life, but also kind of cementing into your child's mind that this is important.
Mm. I do want to make sure to take a minute or two to talk about the seventh part of your book, which is called Little Nuggets. And I found this to be such an intriguing suggestion for parents. What are the little nuggets that you think can be helpful for this cause? And what would be one or two examples of such little nuggets?
Sure. Little nuggets, I love little nuggets because, you know, with the earlier parts, like discussion, like going deeper, I think parents make the assumption, and fairly, that, you know, these always deserve like very long conversations or very long talks. And they don't have to be. You know, you can always just give your kids snippets. And I think this is especially true as kids get older and they're using their phones more often. They're off with their friends. You know, you're not always sitting around at the dinner table, you know, having hour-long conversations about anything, right? Because you just don't have time. We got sports. We got play, the school play. We have after-school activities. So people are busy. And so little nuggets is this ability for people to put things out there with their kids, to share information. Again, it's a part of going deeper, but it's also in a kind of short, succinct way. So my favorite ways to kind of do little nuggets are text messages, especially if you have kiddos who have phones. So texting a kiddo and, you know, saying like, oh, I read this new article and this is what I found out. And it's, you know, connected to this thing that we talked about a little while ago. I thought you would want to know, you know, kind of sending them that little snippet, whether it's the link to the article or just an interesting part of it. I think to like, you know, having your kid, you know, talk about like, you know, when you're maybe in the car or on your way to school or something like that, just mentioning something that you learned about recently or that you heard on a podcast or that you read in another article. So just kind of giving your kid little snippets, maybe some facts and figures or just some interesting factoids that might be of interest to them. Of course, I can't come up with anything super specific off the top of my head right now, but something little like that can be really powerful because it just kind of gets them, you know, recognizing that this is something that, you know, you can kind of infuse into your life in a very like quick, you know, way. It doesn't have to feel heavy all the time. I think so often people think of diversity and culture as like this heavy topic, but it doesn't have to be. It can be joyful, and there's a lot of things we can share in that way as well.
Absolutely. And you tell us that there's sort of an art to using these little nuggets in how they are offered and when they are offered and so on. And I appreciate all that you suggest about that. A last question. You yourself are a mother, and I wonder how much of what we find in this book, Culturally Competent Kids, springs out of that real life experience.
Sure. So yes, the short answer is yes. It's certainly something that I've been talking with my kids about for years. And I think that, you know, I think it's really important for my kids to understand who they are and, you know, the world around them. I try not to put too much, I don't know if I'm always great at it. I try not to put too much pressure on them because this is mommy's work, not just, you know, like life and stuff. And so I try not to make it seem as if they're part of my work. But the work that I have in this book is what I live. And so, my kids and I consistently have conversations about these topics. And there are ways in which, you know, I talk to them. I'm like, oh, we're doing so great. This is so amazing. Like this little thing that they told me, that's a really interesting thing. And then there are some times when I talk to them and I'm like, oh, we have a ways to go here. But I think, you know, to ask whether or not they are culturally competent, the answer is of course not. They're still learning and growing just like I am. But the important part here, too, is that I am also not culturally competent. There are always things that I need to do differently. There are always things that I make mistakes at. And I don't shrink from that. I don't hide that from my kids. I let them know when I make mistakes. I let them know when I'm messing up, too. And I also let them know that I want to be better. And so that's all, you know, that I can really hope for with my kids. And then I hope that, you know, other people, you know, in reading this book and doing this work with their own kids, feel the same way.
The book again is Culturally Competent Kids, Raising Children to Thrive in a Diverse World, published by Bull Publishing, and the author, Dr. Samantha C. Sweeney. Dr. Sweeney, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show and for sharing about your really interesting book. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Part two of today's program comes from the Morning Show Archives, a lighthearted conversation recorded and initially broadcast back in the summer of 2001. For the next few minutes, I'm going to be speaking on the Morning Show with Professor Anders Henriksen, a professor of history at Shepherd College, located just outside of Washington, D.C. And more to the point for the Morning Show today, Professor Anders Henriksen is also the author or editor or whatever we want to say, presides over a really entertaining book, which happens to be New York Times bestseller, called Non Compos Mentis, World History According to College Students. From the Stone Age to the Canadian Missile Crisis, Joan of Arc to the fall of the Berlin Wall. Maybe you have a sense already about what this book contains and what makes it so hilariously entertaining. Professor Anders Henriksen, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thanks, glad to be here.
When did you get the idea for putting this book together?
It goes back to the 1970s, really, when I was a graduate teaching assistant at the University of Toronto, and I was grading a stack of freshman papers, and they were all about Machiavelli, the great Italian political philosopher who passed away in the 1500s, and one student wrote that Machiavelli wrote The Prince to get a job with Richard Nixon. And I started to laugh so hard, and my wife thought it was a medical issue. I mean, she was in a different room and came in, and I read it to her, and she said, "You've got to start saving these." And I think, you know, every professor, every teacher sees this kind of stuff, but I got into the habit of saving it and collecting it from friends and colleagues across the U.S. and Canada. And a couple of years ago, I realized that I really had enough material to string this into, I guess we could call it an alternate narrative of world history.
Yes.
Hence the book.
Before we just read a couple of really funny excerpts, I want to ask you first, if I don't want this to sound too heavy, but did you have any ethical hesitation whatsoever about doing this? About taking the words that, you know, presumably a college student wrote in good faith, in all earnestness, hapless though the efforts might have been. Any hesitation at all about doing this?
Well, not really, because of the response of students. I mean, over the years, I have shared the funny things with students, and I'm very, very careful not to ever reveal the name of the student who wrote these things, because my purpose in life is absolutely not to ridicule students. I'm a teacher. I care about what they learn, and I care about their feelings. But students find it funny, and I've never encountered anyone who's ever been offended by it, and it's certainly not intended in that way.
Let me ask you one more kind of semi-heavy question, which is, we can read this and we can laugh our heads off. That's what I did, but you can stop and think about it, and it's also kind of scary or disturbing or disappointing. I mean, there can be kind of a negative response to this as well. What's your response to that?
Well, it does give one pause for thought. It's possible to get into college and not know that Spain and Mexico are really two separate countries, things like this. But I think we've got to take this in perspective, because this is not a survey of the average student's preparedness. I have many, many students who are very bright, well-informed people who write wonderful English. That's the majority of them. And I think students have always done this. As long as there have been people who've been panicked on exams, who haven't studied, who didn't pay attention when they should have paid attention, who don't proofread, you're going to get funny things like this. So I think, yeah, I mean, it is a cause for concern that there are clearly some students in college who really aren't in touch with very much in the world out there. But it isn't a representative sample. And I really did this not to send a heavy message, but really because it's a comedic angle to the human condition, I think.
It really is. One thing that really impressed me is that I have no patience for, and I'm not the least bit amused by, these things that you sometimes see on the internet and elsewhere, where you'll see a bunch of things that are purported to be excerpts from, let's say, for instance, church bulletins, mm-hmm. where announcements have been worded poorly. But, I mean, so many of those efforts clearly are not authentic. I mean, you can just tell that somebody concocted this funny way to say something. But I read this book, and it strikes me as very real. This is not a professor someplace dreaming up ways to kind of twist things around and make them hilariously funny. These seem to be entirely authentic, and are they?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think it would be possible to make these up. There's a certain flavor to them. There's a certain naivete, and I think anyone who teaches, who sees a lot of student prose, is going to recognize this stuff instantly. It's really not manufacturable, I don't think.
Right. I was reading, for instance, the chapter about the Russian Revolution, where someone is trying to explain to us that Nicholas II let himself be pulled into strainful positions by his wife. To make matters worse, his son was diagnosed with hemophilatism, a sickness which required him to fall down and hurt himself badly.
Poor child.
Yeah, right. It's kind of interesting because you can tell this was at least a college student trying to put something in his own words, but just not quite managing to do it.
Often it's language skills. You know, the student may have some sort of sense of what they're trying to convey, but they just don't get the words quite right.
Right. Or spelling errors that can be, hilariously funny is when someone is describing Mozart's opera Don Giovanni, which is about Don Juan, D-O-N-W-O-N.
One of the few Chinese Spaniards in history, I think.
Yes, exactly. Or a Hawaiian singer, I was thinking.
That reminded me of, too.
But as you've put this together, these are excerpts from all kinds of different things. About how many anonymous student authors are we talking about here?
Well, almost as many as there are sentences in the book, so we're several hundred. And they're scattered all across the U.S. and Canada. There's even one entry from Oxford University in Britain.
Hmm. It's interesting how sometimes there'll be very short little statements that are almost profound, such as, during the Dark Ages, it was mostly dark.
Tough times.
Right. Or the ancient Greeks founded the Olympics in about 1896, where they are just skirting on the edge of being correct, but not quite.
Yeah, there's just enough off. Parallel universe, I think you could say.
Yeah, something like that. You say that you've been collecting these down through the years. What kind of span of time are we talking about in the pages of this book? What would the earliest contributions date back to?
Mid-70s.
Hmm.
So that literally would be people who are old enough to be the parents of today's students.
What's kind of intriguing is you also have something here which you call the postscript, subtitled The Meaning of All This, in which you try to explore some of this. What is that all about?
Well, I'm trying to set the thing in perspective. I guess to answer in a way the sort of heavy question you posed at the beginning of the interview, what does it tell us? Does it mean anything? And I guess my message is that really it's it's an example of the way humans behave under stress, but also if it tells us anything about this generation. What it's telling us is that I think we live in a culture that really doesn't value the understanding of the past the way it should. For a historian, that's really kind of frustrating. We live in a society which is so focused on what's happening now and what's going to happen tomorrow. I think Americans and Canadians have always been this way. I think also we live in a society where people don't read books, and that shows in a lack of language skills with a lot of these kids.
Right. Abominable spelling and this and that. Well, and when people end up talking about Martin Luther Jr.'s famous If I Had a Hammer speech,
yeah,
or his wheeling and dealing with President Lyndon B. Johnson, something's going on there that's not quite right.
Yeah. And again, I'm hesitant just, to condemn the schools, because some of them do a great job, and they're great teachers out there. I think it's just the whole mindset of the culture. And one of the other issues, too, I remember one of the reasons I got into being a historian was sitting and talking with my parents and my older relatives about what it was like in the 20s and 30s and 40s. And I think that we're such a rushed society, I think we're so mobile, I wonder how many of these students really sit down with grandparents or aunts and uncles or even parents and talk about what, the 1960s were like.
I do like how you take a moment to offer the reader the chance to take a quiz, lest they become a bit too complacent. Tell us a little more about why that is here.
Well, I gave, at the end of the book, there's a little quiz that really asks questions that I would expect a student who's just finished a freshman History of Civilization course to be able to answer. And it's just to give the reader of this a little perspective, I guess, to bring us down to earth a little bit about some very basic historical information that we might also not have at our fingertips.
And, this is really something, and I will say it is a very humbling little quiz. For instance, the first question you pose, in what decade or decades did the following occur? And then there follows the Boxer Rebellion, the Boer War, the unification of Italy, the Crimean War, the Congress of Vienna, the Cuban Missile Crisis. And another question you asked, during which century did the following live? Cleopatra, Charlemagne, Constantine, Muhammad, Martin Luther, Confucius. You ask another question, who are these people? And then there is a list of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and I know 4 of them. And I think of myself as fairly well-read, but not well-read enough. It's a nice way to do this. You also have a world map that is very interesting. Where does that come from?
Well, that is taken in part. It's a transfer to the map of some of the verbal things that are in the book. But in part, it's material taken from map questions on college exams. I give map questions to the freshmen. I ask them to find things like France, and sometimes it ends up in South America, you know. And I have a geography colleague at Shepherd who regularly does this, and he shares with me a good deal of his material.
I really like the subtitle of the book, which appears on the back, Mangled Moments of Western Civilization from Term Papers and Blue Book Exams. That really kind of sums up where all of this comes from. Do we look forward to Volume 2 and 3 and 4?
I hope so. One of the response, of course, right now we're in the middle of exam period. I call it harvest time.
Yeah, right.
And, of course, students continue to do this. And I've actually built a wider network of colleagues since the book has come out. People have just contacted me. I had one gentleman from New Zealand send me 20 pages of email attachment of his collection, which he's willing to let me use in a future book. So, yes, I'm planning to write another, at least one sequel to this.
Very good. Well, the book is fabulous and hysterically funny. Non Campus Mentis, World History According to College Students, compiled and edited by Professor Anders Henriksen, published by Workman Publishing. And Professor Henriksen, despite the heavy questions I posed there at the beginning, I really enjoyed this book thoroughly, and I think anyone would. And I thank you for writing it and for joining us today on The Morning Show to talk about it.
Well, thank you. My pleasure to be here.
Amazing.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, my conversation with John Magaris, talking about his newly published biography of James DeCoven. How many times have you driven past the DeCoven Center on the south side of Racine and wondered about that name, DeCoven? James DeCoven was a 19th century Episcopalian clergyman and educator for whom the DeCoven Center is named. And John Magaris' biography about him is a truly fascinating book. We'll talk about it tomorrow. On Wednesday, speaking of fascinating books, my guest is British writer and farmer James Rebanks, whose latest book is a remarkable memoir called A Place of Tides, in which he recounts the experience of spending several months living and working on a tiny remote island off the coast of Norway. On Thursday, in an interview postponed from last week, Yvonne McDonald-Hames joins me, Executive Director of Halo Incorporated, Racine's largest homeless shelter. And this Friday, two interviews for Pride Month, one of them Robert Trachtenberg, author of When I Knew, in which an array of gay people tell the story of when they first knew that they were gay. Some stories hilariously funny and some quite poignant. Part two features Christopher Rice, son of best-selling author Anne Rice, talking about his queer romance, Party of Three. The Morning Show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. The program is archived on our website, wgtd.org. Well, the heat wave continues again today. We are headed to a high of 94 degrees. We do have some relief on the way, but with that relief also intermittent rain. Tonight, a 50% chance of thunderstorms. They could be strong. Overnight low of 73. Tomorrow's high, 84 degrees with a 40% chance of rain. The chance of rain escalates to 70% tomorrow night with a low of 63. Wednesday and Wednesday night, a 50% chance of showers and thunderstorms and a reasonable high of 75. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Rec.